The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing, from the use of probiotics and folic acid to what exercise is doing and what a bad diet does for your teeth and also your body. And my guest in the second part of our program is Dr. Merle Nass. She's a board-certified physician in internal medicine. And we're going to talk about her research on the anthrax vaccine that President Obama and Health and Human Services are suggesting being given to all of American children. Now, that brings back the work that I did earlier on Gulf War vets who got sick using the anthrax vaccine. This would be the same vaccine. Why in the world would we give children something that we can prove caused Gulf War syndrome, mold, or chemical sensitivities, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and other related disorders? This is just part of this whole congressional push to vaccinate everybody for everything, and all with the lies, the complete fraud that vaccines are safe and effective. Therefore, I've shifted my program that this evening, where I was going to go into gas hydrofracking, the one-hour special I do every Monday evening on the Progressive Commentary Hour will deal specifically with an original, in-depth investigative report. I will lay out evidence at 7 p.m. tonight that I believe will prove in any court of law that vaccines are associated with neurological damage and autism. I will only be citing peer-reviewed literature, and I believe that we can prove this once and for all. I also today will be uncovering information heretofore never known, never discussed in the American media, that based upon a Freedom of Information Act documents, I can prove that the CDC officials were fully aware of a connection between thimerosal, which is mercury, in vaccines and autism. And they hid this intentionally. How do I know that? We have the emails. And hence, when the peer-reviewed journal Pediatrics said that there was no connection, and that was the end of the story, no, it's not the end of the story. Sooner or later, the truth comes out. So a really in-depth hour that you will not want to miss. It is. I spent the whole weekend researching and writing it. Two stories today at 7 p.m., why the flu shot is a complete fraud. Complete fraud. There's no science supporting the efficacy or safety of the flu vaccine at all. And why all vaccines are dangerous, that there is no science supporting their safety. But specifically, if you know anyone who's involved in the vaccine autism link, they should pay careful attention, because I'll be sharing that with them. All right, that is, then we're moving over till next week, genetic engineering, a whole panel for a whole hour, and then the following one on gas hydrofracking. So we have a lot coming at you today. My commentary today will be from Professor Paul Craig Roberts, Living in a Delusional World. Let's begin. First, on probiotics, most people eat foods that adversely affect the good bacteria in their gut. Hence, they have a predominance of bad bacteria. Bacteria move throughout the body, and once you get a dominance of bad bacteria, the bad bacteria can proliferate, and that's one of the reasons that we are so sick. So we need good bacteria in us, and probiotics provide that. This is from the European Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, and it says the following. Daily supplements of a multi-species probiotic food may reduce the risk of eczema by 58%, according to a major study done in the Netherlands. So if you want to have less eczema, which is very hard for most people to deal with, get the good probiotics into your system and get the sugars and alcohol out, which proliferate in inflammation and bad bacteria. Now, one good thing that folic acid does, among other things, it protects against fetal heart defects. This is so important when you realize how many fetuses end up with some form of congenital abnormalities. And this is from the Canadian Press, and it says, quote, since Canada introduced mandatory fortification of grain products with folic acid more than a decade ago, the number of babies born with severe congenital heart defects have dropped significantly. A McGill University study found a substantial decline in cases of severe congenital heart defects in the province after it was implementing folic acid. So, for everyone else in the world who's listening, if you are pregnant, make sure you're taking folic acid supplements each day. This was published in the British Medical Journal. Vitamin D can halt lung function decline in asthma and very serious lung conditions. That's according to Science Daily. Now, we know that we can get vitamin D in the summertime. That's easy. Get about 20 to 30% of your body exposed to about an hour's worth of sunlight, and you have your vitamin D. But in the wintertime, in the fall, people go to work early. It gets dark early, and they're generally inside. That means that you're going to end up with a slow progressive decline in vitamin D, which also means then you're going to have a decline in the ability to breathe, especially if you have asthma or if you have any form of human airway smooth muscle proliferation, and this according to University of Pennsylvania. So if you want to have better breathing, vitamin D, I suggest 3,000 to 5,000 units a day. There's an oil that's very healing when you breathe it in. It's lavender oil. Now, generally, if you went to any of the medicinals or herbal or apothecary guides, they would talk about lavender oil. It's used in Ayurvedic medicine. It's used in Chinese medicine, Japanese medicine. But this is from Science Daily. This is mainstream science and published in the International Journal of Environmental Health. Here's what it says. Lavender oil is a natural herbicide. Quote, could essential oils extracted from lavender be used as a natural herbicide to prevent weed growth from among crops? Researchers carried out the research in Italy and reported in the current issue of International Journal of Environmental Health Science. The answer is yes. Now, why is this important? Well, because what ends up happening on most crops is you get parasites, insects, bacteria, viruses, fungi, and weeds. So they'll spray one kind of chemical to get rid of the bugs, another to get rid of the weeds, both of which are relatively ineffective. I've used for as long as I can remember, I've used cinnamon oil, peppermint oil, and lavender oil. I put it into a mister with garlic oil and I sprayed on my plants. And guess what? I have zero loss. I can't remember the last time any of the crops that I grow, and I'm a certified organic farmer and I'm a beekeeper. I have 40 hives. I don't end up with colony collapse, don't end up with infestations. Why? First, it's how you care for them. And I care for a plant the same way as for human body. Rather than deal with the symptoms that occur after you have an illness, work on building up the person's constitution and the plant's constitution. So therefore, by giving healthy fertilization on a regular basis. Now, normally, people fertilize twice a year if they're lucky, sometimes once a year. I believe we should fertilize every week, every 7 days. You have fruit trees, you have vegetables, and the best way is spraying on the fertilizer. What that means is your crops take in the nutrients and become super strong. Therefore, the defense mechanisms, the immune system of a plant, a lettuce or an apple or a peach or an avocado, becomes very strong, just like you would be if you took all your nutrients and phytonutrients. Now, when they're exposed to, for example, freezing weather, they may get a burn off and lose their leaves, but the energy in the root structure is strong enough that it withstands it, and it comes back in the spring, and then suddenly it's stronger. Where other people didn't do it, their plants die. So instead of having to use any synthetic pesticides and herbicides, just have healthier plants, and that just requires more feeding of the plants. And then spray them, but with a natural spray, the essential oils. And why would you assume that an essential oil would be good for a human, not good for a plant? Because insects don't like these oils. They irritate them. They burn them. In fact, there are certain plants that give off their own oils, which are very toxic. Like, a lot of people will plant mustard plant, mustard leaf, which is strong. I mean, it's not the kind of thing you want to juice because it'll really do a number on you. But if you're planting it around, it acts, the essential oils in that leaf protect other plants in its immediate vicinity. It's called interplanting. So, again, my suggestion, cinnamon, peppermint, and lavender with garlic. You put it into a mister and you just spray them. All right? But now their mainstream science, and especially agricultural science, is catching up. So that's good. Now, black pepper, I've talked about black pepper as being very important for our healing. Most people, they don't know about black pepper. But what we know about black pepper is that it can do many things. It can reduce pain, reduces inflammation, helps combat arthritis. And that's been shown for a long time. But now we see in new studies that black pepper can block complications from diabetes. It's a very powerful antioxidant, and it fights colon cancer. And it has a very high degree of bioavailable nutrients, and it's just terrific. It's just most people don't use black pepper, and they should. Now, there's an active ingredient, piperine, P-I-P-E-R-I-N-E. The active phenolic compound in black pepper extract. And when we look at it, it's very powerful, turning off inflammation in your muscles, in your joints, in the connective tissue. And that makes it excellent for arthritis and fibromyalgia and gout. And piperine inhibits the expression of pro-inflammatory interleukin 6 and MMP 13, a gene involved in promoting arthritis and metastasis. And piperine reduces this pro-inflammatory prostaglandin, even at low doses. And when I'm suggesting people with arthritis, I suggest they take it in a more concentrated capsule so they really get it into their cells. And you can read this in Arthritis Research and Therapy. It's there in the peer-reviewed literature. But also, we know that there's a lot we could do using black pepper, ginger, cumin, cinnamon, and green tea. Those are all extracts tested that show significant ability to lessen advanced glycation end products. Now, what's advanced glycation end products? That's how we end up aging prematurely. Remember I gave you this example, a plump, moist chicken, put it in the oven, 2 hours later it's brown and crisp. Well, those plump cells, those are your young cells, and as we get older and expose ourselves to environmental toxins on the outside and taking in alcohol and processed foods and fried foods on the inside, we create these particular chemicals, and these are called advanced glycation end products. And protein glycation is a process in which sugar molecules bond to protein molecules without enzymatic control. And the result is accumulation of these end products, and all that speeds up the disease process, whether you have diabetes, cancer, heart disease, or simply aging. It ages you prematurely. So one more reason to use your superstars: black pepper, ginger, cumin, cinnamon, and green tea. They are all anti-aging and antioxidants. And black pepper is an antioxidant. Who would have thought that it's an antioxidant? Helping with diabetes, cancer, and diabetes. But the polyphenols are very potent. And the National Institutes of Nutrition in India, where they use a lot of pepper there, probably more than any other place on earth, they generate an enormous amount of scientific literature on the antioxidant phenolic content of plants, because they want to be able to have people who don't have enough money for a lot of different foods to at least use spices that can help control many of the diseases. And that's why you'll see legumes and cereal grains and oil seeds and oils and leafy green vegetables and spices and roots and tubers very common in the diet in India. But black pepper had the highest level, number one level of antioxidant activity, and also the highest phenolic content, and therefore very, very good for them. That was the International Journal of Food Science and Nutrition. And remember, if you want to prevent colorectal cancer, black pepper can do that. There was a study at St. Louis University in Missouri, and it tested whether or not black pepper, resveratrol from grapes, and a cinnamon compound, what is called a cinnamon aldehyde from cinnamon, had anti-prolific effects on colon cancer. And what they found was that it was the black pepper showed significant anti-proliferative activity at 24 and 48 and 72 hours following the research, and that was in clinical laboratory sciences. Better digestion, also black pepper. It has a diuretic effect, it reduces bloating, it reduces intestinal bloating in particular and gas. And see, the outer layer, the peppercorn, can even stimulate the breakdown of fat cells and releasing energy and keeping you slim. So just another nutrient that we don't pay much attention to, and we should, because it's important for us. And finally, science finally gets around to doing some really good research on vitamin C and diabetes, and it says, gee whiz, a team of British and American scientists found that a combination of therapy of insulin and vitamin C can stop disease-related blood vessel damage in patients with type 1 diabetes. Those are children. This was done at the Harold Hamm Diabetes Center in Oklahoma and the University Hospital Coventry in the UK. And they use vitamin C or insulin therapy or both over a period of time. And then they measured the endothelial, which are the blood vessels, injuries and blood flow and oxidative stress and the suffering. And the results revealed that either therapy was mildly effective for those of a recent diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, but that only the combination of insulin and vitamin C was completely effective, particularly for longer suffering participants. This was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. So if you have someone you know who suffers from type 1 diabetes, which I believe is due to vaccines, then you'll want to make sure that they're getting vitamin C with their insulin. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We're going to go to Elizabeth in a second in our studio in New York. I'm out on the road, but our issue of the day, which I'm then going to ask you to call in and share your points of view on, my guest, following Elizabeth on Dr. Merle Nass on the idea that we're going to be giving an anthrax vaccine to children. Well, gee whiz, for all those of you who are still supporting this president, or the Democratic Party supporting this president, they're the ones supporting giving your child vaccines, anthrax vaccine, one of the single most toxic, fraudulent vaccines ever created. Why in the world wouldn't anyone speak up? Why does it have to be someone within the vaccine movement who is found having trusted the system that betrayed them? Can't we see what's coming and then make appropriate decisions? Evidently not. And that's just one of the many failures that I see happening out there. But we are going to address it in a few moments. But here's our issue of the day, and this is from Professor Paul Greg Roberts from Counterpunch, and I'll quote it. It's not very long, but I thought it was important. I've come to the conclusion that Big Brother's subjects in Orwell's 1984 are rather better informed than most Americans. Americans have no idea why they have been at war in the Middle East, Asia, and Africa for a decade. They don't realize that their liberties have been supplanted by a Gestapo police state. Few understand that hard economic times are here to stay. Just a few days ago, the U.S. government announced some routine economic statistics, and the president of the European Council announced a new approach to the Greek sovereign debt. The result of these funny numbers and mere words sent the Standard & Poor's 500 index to its largest monthly rally since 1974, and the euro rose, putting the European currency again 40% above its initial parity with U.S. dollar when the euro was introduced. On National Public Radio, a half-wit analyst, by the way, are there any other, declared emphatically that the latest U.S. government statistics prove that the recovery was in place and there was no danger whatsoever of a double-dip recession. And the half-brain economists predicted a better tomorrow. Europe is happy because the European private banks, the creditors of the European government, have agreed to eat 50% of Greece's sovereign debt and be recapitalized by public money handed to them by the European Financial Stability Facility Rescue Fund. The president of the European Council thinks that Greece's debt is the only sovereign debt to be written down and that the debt of Italy, Spain, and Portugal will somehow be bailed out through other means. For our corrupt financial markets, any news that can be spun as good news can send stocks up. But what are the facts? For facts, one has to turn to serious people, not to the general media. Among those who give us real facts is John Williams of ShadowStats.com. In his current report, Williams exposes the happy second quarter of 2011 economic growth figures of 2.5% as nonsense. Every other economic indicator contradicts the spin. For example, personal consumption is reported to have increased 1.7%, but the surge in consumption took place despite a 1.7% collapse in consumer disposable income. In other words, if there was an increase in personal consumption, it came from using people's savings accounts or credit cards. They incurred higher debt. A country's consumers cannot forever draw down on their savings or go deeper into credit card debt. For an economy to recover, there must be growth in consumer income. That growth is nowhere to be seen in the United States. A large percentage of the goods and services sold to Americans by American corporations are now produced abroad by foreign labor. Thus, Americans no longer receive incomes from the production of the goods and services that they consume. The American consumer market is on its way out. The Dow Jones rose 339 points on the phony good news, but consumer sentiment is in the basement. John Williams reports that consumer confidence hit the lowest level ever recorded in 2008-2009. The consumer confidence has now fallen back to those levels. But the stock market boomed. Somehow a population 23% unemployed with debt up to its eyeballs is going to spark an economic recovery. It's nonsense. Lies. Recovery can only happen in the delusional world created by us, by the concentrated media. No longer permitted to utter one word of truth, the press proclaims non-existent recoveries and weapons of mass destruction and demonize Washington's chosen opponents. The sovereign debt crisis in Europe has distracted America from much worse crisis in our own country. For two decades of exporting U.S. manufacturing and middle-class jobs, and after a decade of consumer debt growth that has resulted in millions of foreclosed homes and massive credit card and student loan debt that cannot ever be repaid, consumers have no income growth or borrowing capacity with which to fuel an economy based on consumer demand. European banks, already ruined by purchases of Standard & Poor's and Moody's AAA ratings of junk derivatives, now find themselves threatened by sovereign debt. Greece's debt crisis, caused by Goldman Sachs, helped in hiding the true debt of the country, as was done for Enron, has brought to light that a Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Spain, in addition to Greece, have more debt than the governments can service. In the European zone, unlike the U.S. and U.K., which have their own central banks that can create money whenever they want to bail out anyone to any degree they want, the European central banks are prohibited from, by treaty, from printing money in order to purchase bonds from member states that cannot be redeemed. Regardless of the treaty prohibition, the European Union Central Bank has been lending Greece the money to pay its bondholders. And those are whom? Banks. The imposed austerity that is part of the deal created political instability in Greece. Now that European President Council, Herman Van Rompuy, has announced a 50% write-off by private banks of Greek sovereign debt, can the same treatment be denied Portugal, Italy, Spain, and Ireland? The European Central Bank is following the lead of the Federal Reserve in creating a new money to bail out debt. The cost will be paid in inflation and flight from the euro and the dollar. As an indication of the future, despite the positive spin on the news and the rise in U.S. stocks, the Japanese yen rose to a new high against U.S. dollar. Okay, my thoughts on this. I've been saying all along, watch Greece. Greece is the canary in the coal mine. I believe that initially they have pushed through, and Greece's parliament is completely corrupt. They get double pensions there, the members of the parliament, meaning they get a full life pension from whatever job they had before they went into the parliament. Once they even serve just two short terms, they get another pension, a government pension for life. They get new Mercedes-Benz. They get all these perks. It's utterly corrupt. So it was obvious they were going to say, yes, give us billions to pay some bills, and we will cut back all of our country's salaries and pensions by 20%, and we will fire 30,000 government workers. And they went through all this. Do they really think that the people in Greece are going to tolerate this? The Greece citizens will not tolerate this. They'll bring down the government in the next 12 months and then declare that they are going to forfeit and all the debt and then watch everyone scramble. And behind that will come Spain with a 5 times larger economy. And then where do you think America is going to sit in this whole mess? Because Wall Street has hundreds of billions invested over there. So you're going to see a big awakening in the very near future. That's my prediction. Anyhow, I'm going to play a short segment that I think you'll find of interest that will give you a little different perspective on what Americans should know who are out there in the streets. It's an Occupy clip, because I believe that in the next 4 to 6 weeks, unless there's some really good leadership with very specific directions, and going against the common trend that, you know, let anarchy reign, and we just want to show people we're against corruption and the excess power of Wall Street, that in and of itself, those platitudes don't change systems. You need organization, you need a lot of work, and you need to take a lesson from history. Otherwise, it'll just dissipate, and there'll be a lot of internal conflict, and some of the more important parts of this movement will be co-opted by the left. Here's a thought for you.
This is an open message to the Occupy Wall Street movement, to the 99%. Revolutions are dangerous and unpredictable beasts. And for a population to enter into one without fully understanding what's at stake is a lot like handing a loaded .45 automatic to a toddler. On the other hand, all it takes is a cursory look at the psychopathic criminals which have taken control of the governments of the world to understand why a revolution is inevitable. This is why it's so important that people who are pushing for change take the time and the effort to deeply consider how we got into this mess and what the real solution is. Otherwise, this movement, like so many others which have come before, will be co-opted, twisted, and distorted, and could result in even more power being handed to those who you're trying to fight. Now, you have every reason to be angry. You, your children, and your children's children have been sold into slavery. Literally. If you're lucky enough to have a job in the years to come, you'll end up paying between 25 and 30% of your income in taxes, the majority of which will go directly towards paying interest on debts to privately owned banks. Think about that. 25 to 30%. That means you work between 3 and 4 months each year for the bankers. That's slavery, pure and simple. It's a cleverly disguised form of modern feudalism. And it's not new. It didn't start with the bailouts. The bailouts were just icing on the cake. It was just a little bit too much for most people to swallow. But in reality, the events of the last several years are just an escalation of standard policy. If you truly want to break free from slavery, it's crucial to understand the nature of your enslavement. It's crucial that the masses come to realize that all major currencies, the dollar and the euro in particular, are created out of thin air by privately owned banks. Those banks create money backed by nothing. Then they loan that money out to governments in exchange for bonds, which are really just promises that the government will extract that money plus interest from the public. That money is extracted from the people in the form of taxes, and those taxes are taken at gunpoint. Sure, you may not have ever seen the gun in your face, but if you ever refuse to comply, men with guns will show up at your house and drag you off to rot in a cage. Perhaps some people don't want to look at this reality. It's not a flattering image. You don't want to think of yourself as a slave to the 1%, to the private bankers which hold the reins of power. But positive thinking is not going to change things for the better. People who want to fight for real change must take the time to research the true nature of money. Only with that understanding will we be in a position to push for meaningful reforms. The solution is not equitable taxation. Calling for equitable taxation is like calling for equitable slavery. And if you waste your energy trying to establish an equal level of tax slavery for everyone, then you're going to miss the opportunity to end the enslavement itself. It is utterly immoral to use violence or the threat of violence to take the property or the labor of another person. But perhaps you've been taught otherwise. Perhaps you've been taught that it's okay for the state to use violence to steal from the public. Perhaps you believe that such violence is okay if it's being done for a quote-unquote good cause. I hate to break the bad news, but the ends do not justify the means. And if you're honest with yourself, you'll have to admit that the ends don't ever seem to quite materialize as promised, do they? In the end, you're given a few half-assed services and social programs, but the vast majority of your money goes straight into the pockets of the bankers and the war profiteers. And it always will if you keep turning to government thugs to enforce your good intentions. You might think that you can change this by creating new laws and regulations, but the fatal flaw in that line of reasoning is the simple fact that if private bankers are allowed to continue creating money, the financial powers that be will always end up using the government like a sock puppet. And those new regulations, as well-intentioned as they may be, will only end up consolidating their power. Right now, there are those in positions of influence which are attempting to redirect and co-opt the Occupy Wall Street movement. A good example of this is the Vatican, which this past week took it upon themselves to propose the establishment of a new global central bank as a solution to these problems. This is the kind of ridiculous proposition that you're going to find being injected into the debate. Those who are in power will do almost anything to stay in power. And the easiest way to do that is to influence the direction of the movement and the solutions which are demanded. Those who created the problem, the real powers that be, don't mind when you react, just as long as they are able to direct that reaction towards artificial solutions which funnel more power into their hands. Problem, reaction, solution. The Hegelian dialectic. It's the oldest trick in the book. Don't fall for it.
Giving you something to think about, let's hear your thoughts. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and that's our issue of the day. I believe that unless they really pay attention and they get organized and go away from this, all of our ideas are important, we all want to keep our ideas sovereign to ourselves, that we believe in one larger principle, that's fine. But that will cause your movement to just be nothing more than a bubble. The public within the next 6 to 8 weeks will work against you. You'll get a backlash. You'll be co-opted, all for nothing. So from those of us in the field of environmental and human rights and civil rights and feminist rights, all the major movements, please turn around and take a look. There's a big history lesson there. And if you can learn from that, then you don't have to start all over again reinventing what's necessary in any movement to make it work. Elizabeth is in studio. We're going to Elizabeth before we go to our guest, Dr. Merle Nass. Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
Good afternoon, Gary. Very well, thank you. How are you? A lot of people have been asking in the last 6 months whether you would consider doing another bulk foods offer, whereby you offer the bulk-sized bags of 25 pounds grains and legumes at wholesale prices. This way it would give people a chance to store up their food in advance in the event of an emergency, and then if the worst case doesn't happen, they can use it or give it away, perhaps to homeless shelters. So would you consider doing this one last time, please?
I would consider it, but the last time we did it, a lot of people took months to come and pick it up, and we have absolutely zero space for storage. I will do this. I'll give people a chance to buy bulk for themselves, but you make them sign a statement that if they're not there to pick it up within 7 days, you donate it to Sacred Heart Church in Camden, New Jersey. Priest Michael Dowd's sanctuary, because he has thousands of hungry people in Camden. He feeds and he doesn't get help. I'm willing to do that. Isn't it interesting that last week we had a freak once this century snowstorm very deep in New Jersey that knocked out all the power. Trains didn't run, people's power's out, refrigerators defrosted. It was cold, but they didn't have electricity. And then people began to think, gee whiz, maybe Gary was right when he said to have a backup generator. Mm-hmm. Remember, because just earlier I was lecturing down in Deal, which I will never do again, to a group of very selfish people who were so self-absorbed that even while I was lecturing, this just never happens. And I would have walked away, or I would have first let them know I didn't appreciate coming clear out there on my time, on my dime, to do a lecture for them when they were twittering and talking amongst themselves the whole time. It was just so rude. But again, that's part of who they are in this very self-absorbed little community. And I said, you're all prepared at being here at sea level for in case there's an emergency? Do you have backup generators? Do you have backup stored food? Do you have grains and beans and legumes? Things that will last you 5-10 years, or canned goods that will last you at least 3 to 4 years? They didn't care. Ah. And then 3 weeks later, we had what? We had a hurricane. Mm. And guess what happened to all their basements? Flooded. And homes flooded. And then I get a call from my friend who apologized for the people's bad behavior and said, gee whiz, everybody's talking about how they're being charged $100,000 to have all this mold removed and have to redo their basements and all this stuff. And oh, now they want to get a generator, but there's no generators to get because there's no, and there's none available. They've all been sold out. It's very difficult when you know what's going to be coming our way. And people still, in defiance of all science, will say, oh, it can happen. And I remind them of Fukushima. Or I remind them of Mississippi and Alabama, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I remind them of Joplin, Missouri. 14,000 homes destroyed in under 35 minutes, 500 people killed, in some places where there'd never been a tornado, ever. So I guess nothing happens, including your death, until it happens.
Right.
Then it's a little late to decide, maybe now I should plan. Well, I'm telling you the solar storms are coming. How bad they'll be will be based upon whether or not we will do the right thing and put our surge protectors around our nuclear facilities. We have none now. That we will take an old, aging, completely dilapidated electrical grid around America and upgrade it and put 450 electrical surges there. We haven't any now and no plans to do such. They're giving us absolute confidence. Don't worry. Be happy. We'll handle it. And I'm saying, how can you give us any assurance you'll handle this when you've never had a Carrington effect in your lifetime? How do you know that you won't have a complete meltdown? How do you know what the velocity of this new solar wave will be? Solar flares are electrical mass pulses of radiation. How do you know that you're going to be capable of handling it? It'll be just minor. Well, gee whiz, just what happened last week in New Jersey, and still power's out. Last night, I was calling in to do my show over the internet, and I was surprised by how few people were able to listen because their internet was out. So if I know that my internet is capable of going out or my utility's going out, wouldn't it be smart to have a backup generator, candles, flashlights, first aid kit, a water filtration system, food? No matter what, that's just reasonable common sense. But most people lack that, so they will suffer and get angry and run out to stores. They'll have no food or water. It's just like trying to teach people who are absolutely obstreperous that do not tell me the truth, do not tell me the future, I'm refusing, in which case there's nothing you can do. But for those who are open, here's what I'll do. And this is the last time I'm going to do this. this week, just for the next 7 days, anybody who wants to get their bulk items, non-perishables, that can store for years in bulk amounts, they'll contact you and they'll get it, and they have to pick it up within 7 days, and they can have it at the wholesale price. That way they'll save money, and it's for those who want it, and those who don't do it. Okay?
Yeah. They have to come in. They have to come in.
They must come in. They can't call. And, right. And they must pick it up because there's zero room on that floor, as you know. And last time it was, for months people didn't pick their stuff up. This time, they don't pick it up within 7 days. It goes to the church in Camden, New Jersey.
That's right.
Okay?
Thank you.
All right. And they'll come to 89th and Broadway from 8 in the morning till 11 at night for the next 7 days only. And they can get any of the grains and legumes. Make a list of what they can get. Right. Nothing fresh. That way it can be stored. And then I suggest also that they go ahead and get a water filtration system, because if you can't drink water that's healthy, you've got a problem. I also suggest that they try to get a generator, so that at least they have a good quality generator at home. And don't put it in the basement. Wrong place to put a generator. All right? So, and there's lots of ways to make yourself less susceptible to the problems that can happen. Certainly flashlights, candles, backup blankets, and a first aid kit, a good quality first aid kit. All those are simply should be in a person's home all the time. If you don't need them, great. Look, I just called, I got a call that there was a food bank that hadn't gotten much food, and they had a lot of hungry people. So I said, okay. And I sent over some 3,000 pounds of food that I was storing. Fine. Other people have a chance who need it to eat it. If you find you don't need it in storage, and if there's some hungry people you can feed, it's just a good spiritual thing to do to help other people. There's no downside to being prepared, not only for yourself and family and friends, but then helping other people who can use a break also. Okay?
Exactly. Thank you.
Now, we're going to go to our guest in a moment, but we have a few people online, and I wanted to see what their issues are that they're calling in. Let's go to Gerald. Hi, Gerald. You're on the line.
Hello. Yes. I'm curious to know if you have any information about HAARP.
I'm not familiar with it. What is it?
Well, it's a series of antennas in different parts of the world, Alaska and places like that. And people claim that they can cause low-frequency vibration to cause earthquakes and things like that.
I'm not familiar with that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
If you're talking about the military HAARP program, that's a different program that's not based upon antenna. Those are based upon research into creating different wave patterns of sound, and we know that's been going on for a long time because it's caused disruptions in the navigational system of whales, porpoises, dolphins, and other, and also birds in migratory flight.
Right, that's what I'm talking about.
That's not antennas on top of buildings. Antennas on buildings are a different concern. And I was on the Upper West Side protesting with our state legislators, our city council members, and residents to let people know the full danger of electromagnetic pulses coming off those cellular towers that are frequently hidden, disguised, or on buildings, because they can impact people in the immediate vicinity of that building. Thank you, Merle. And Elizabeth, your turn, then we go to our guest.
We've got a guy, Roberto. He listens all the time to WBAI, and he's asking, why does there seem to be so much conflict? Why can't everyone just get along? He says the station's been working against its own best interests all the time. Your comments, please.
When you have two different ideas, or two different groups of ideas of how you believe a station, a program, its management should work, there will be conflict. If you have a more progressive group and you have another group that are more of a local, individual, and political group, you're going to have a conflict, and that's what it has had for a long time. And as a result, what one wants to do and could do is stopped by the other group. And so you stay in this constant struggle. And so well-meaning people, and people who may certainly, and I do believe, want the best interest for the station, are thwarted in those efforts because there's a counterbalancing no to every yes. Or can't we? And the answer is no. And so whether it's the local station board, if you only could watch these and listen, you would think, my goodness, what was the whole purpose of this evening? Just to yell at each other, to block each other, to harass each other, to demean each other, to slander each other, to libel each other? What is this whole process about? And you'll become as frustrated as the people participating. Then neither side gains the day, and you stay in this kind of stalemate. And the management is equally frustrated because it's limited also. The changes they want to make and better programming, they can't. Because there will always be someone who says, you can't get rid of that program, or you got to keep that program. And the same with bad employees or anything else. So as a result, unlike the rest of the world and the rest of companies, the things in the private sector, this is what has been inherited, and this is what we're living with and will in the foreseeable future. So that's why I said when I came back to the station, it was on life support, but now it's in critical care and off life support. That doesn't mean it's thriving. Only when you have more progressive minds working together will you take it to a better place. Okay, thank you. Let's now say hello to my guest, Dr. Meryl Nass. She is a board-certified clinician in internal medicine. She practices at Mount Desert Island Hospital in Bar Harbor, Maine. She also runs a clinic helping treat Gulfwar syndrome, multiple chemical sensitivity conditions like fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. And she is regarded as an expert in biological warfare and bioterrorism, which she has investigated since 1989 and 1992, and was one of those who identified the use of anthrax as a biological weapon in Rhodesia's civil war in the late 1970s. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm very concerned about this administration and the media's acceptance of this without challenge. I'll read this. It says, the Obama administration is considering injecting American children with an anthrax vaccine in an unprecedented scientific experiment that bioethicists say will unnecessarily endanger the youngsters' lives and health. And then it goes into why we need this vaccine. And so I'm very concerned about this. And when I was doing different documentaries and different articles on Gulfwar syndrome, one thing continued to rise above all the rest: depleted uranium, the exposure to biological or chemical warfare agents in Iraq in 1991. Yes, those were complicit. But more than anything, it was the vaccines, because I had so many people tell me that they came down with Gulfwar syndrome after getting the vaccines, even those that never even served in Iraq. Some were so sick after getting the vaccines, including the anthrax vaccine, the botulism vaccine, and other vaccines that were never identified to them in their adjuvants, like squalene, that they couldn't even go to Iraq. And others reported by the time they got to Iraq and got off the planes, they had bleeding out of their mouths and their noses. They had bloody diarrhea. And it was not just a few. One commander told me that 70% of his entire group of soldiers initially were sick with these symptoms, and yet no one was willing to acknowledge it was the vaccines. So I'd like for you to tell us your concern about giving American children an anthrax vaccine. Why in the world would we do that? And then what you know about the anthrax vaccine given to American soldiers, and how much of a difference is there? And then your overarching concerns that this president and this Congress and this Health and Human Services finds this completely normal behavior. The forum is yours.
Thanks. I agree with you. There are a number of papers, both from the United States and Australia, that show that the more vaccine soldiers got for the Gulf War, the more likely they were to get Gulf War syndrome. I certainly have also treated many dozens of soldiers who became ill after anthrax vaccine at the time of the Gulf War, and dozens more who became sick when they got it as part of their military service when it became mandatory in 1998. I think it's an extremely dangerous vaccine. The military itself has acknowledged that 1 to 2% of people who receive it have a serious adverse event. in data that the CDC seems to be frightened to publish, but collected between 2002 and 2007 in 1,500 civilians, 7 to 8% of the people in that trial had a serious adverse event reported to the VAERS system, the FDA-CDC system for looking at adverse events from vaccines. So 7% there. So we know that there are a lot of people who become ill, and many of these people never get better. Now, why children? Well, it's not licensed for children right now. The manufacturer has been trying to expand the market for anthrax vaccine and seems to have had a complicit government that's been happy to assist them. So that in 2008, the government issued a PrEP Act waiver for the manufacturer, so that if anybody who takes this vaccine gets sick, you cannot sue the manufacturer. You might be lucky and get a little bit of money out of the Department of Health and Human Services. So with that directive by the Secretary of DHHS, 3 weeks later, the vaccine was approved for civilians for the first time. And that was for civilian first responders. And ever since it's been licensed, it has not been licensed for children under 18 or for adults over 65. So I'm guessing that the manufacturer is hoping to expand the market into those age groups and therefore somehow worked with the government to suggest that a clinical trial be conducted in children. Another reason may be that if you do a trial in children and you claim that it's safe in little children, then everybody is going to assume it's probably safe in adults. So this is what I'm guessing preceded the decision to conduct a trial. Another important part of this is that the government has now inked contracts for over $2.5 billion worth of anthrax vaccine. The cost per dose has gone up 10 times since 1998. And the manufacturer who bought the plant for about $18 million back in 1998 got the Army to sign an agreement that the Army would basically be their insurance company. The Army indemnified the manufacturer. So if people get sick, the manufacturer doesn't have to pay anything. And therefore, the manufacturer has very little interest in improving the vaccine. Furthermore, the vaccine has not been tested for its efficacy in humans at all, so that you can measure antibody levels, you can measure other parameters in the blood after someone is vaccinated, but no humans that were vaccinated were exposed naturally to anthrax to see whether this vaccine works against anthrax. And in animal models, you can show that even some animals that attain very high antibody levels still die after an exposure, and other animals that have low antibody levels survive an exposure. So the factors that actually lead to survival have not been defined yet. And therefore, doing a trial in children, when you don't know how effective it's going to be, and we know from adults that it's not safe, you're not going to get any useful information. You're going to find that children get sick, and maybe you'll cover that up. You won't be able, all you can do is measure antibody levels, and that's not going to tell you whether children will survive, so you won't really be able to get any useful dosing information. So the whole thing is really a bunch of BS, and the people inside the Beltway don't seem to know that, but everybody else does. And if you look at the comments that people have made to newspaper articles about this, you'll see that the public is uniformly against such a trial.
All right, let's go further. Explain the difference. Well, explain why we would need to vaccinate millions upon millions of children when there's almost zero probability they would come down with an anthrax. And also, it was the Russians who were weaponizing anthrax back in the 1970s and 80s, but then they stopped that. And we took their old work as if that would be something Saddam Hussein would have used. He may have had his scientists duplicate it, may even have gotten some of that from Russia. But none of that has been proven today. Why are we willing to put at risk children to give a whole nation, a whole generation, what would amount to Gulf War syndrome in our children into the hundreds of thousands if you look at how many soldiers were vaccinated and how many came down with Gulf War Syndrome because of that.
Right.
Look at the magnitude. We would be making millions of American children suffer in the rest of their life with symptoms similar to Gulf War Syndrome. I do not see any ethical justification or scientific justification for this at all.
No, there's none. And there are many other biological weapons that could be used against us. So if we were to vaccinate everybody against anthrax and we had a vaccine that actually worked, then the enemy just picks out a different bioweapon to use. Another important thing about anthrax is that it isn't contagious from person to person. So that unless somebody was able to sprinkle anthrax effectively over the entire United States, which would require a lot of airplanes up in the air for a long time, you really are not going to be able to affect a huge number of people with an attack. And once the anthrax spores get on the ground, they don't usually re-aerosolize to make people sick. That's not invariable, but most of the time they bind to particles of dirt and other things on the ground, and that's it. You know, you're only exposed while the spores are in the air. So the whole concept is flawed from start to finish. Even if there were an outbreak, it would be very small. There's no reason to think about doing this to large numbers of children. And you need yearly boosters. So it would mean, again, if you were serious about vaccinating people, this particular vaccine, a shot every year after an initial 5 shots.
If you had a chance to speak with President of the United States, who's 100% pro-vaccine, and Congress, which is pro-vaccine, Health and Human Services, the American Academy of Allergy and Infectious Disease, which oversees vaccines, the National Institute of Health, the National Academy of Science, National Library of Medicine, all of which are part of this, what would you tell them?
I've unfortunately had the chance to talk to some of those bodies, and they weren't interested in hearing what I had to say. I think the most important thing for everybody to be aware of is that Congress told the CDC to do a trial on anthrax vaccine. And Congress did not trust the military data, which was acknowledged to be very flawed by FDA. So CDC finally conducted a trial in 1,500 people between 2002 and 2007, but has never published the final results of that trial. And in that trial, there were 229 serious adverse events reported. So here's the government did the trial. It's the government's own data in civilians. We need to look at it before you buy anthrax vaccine, before you, you know, increase the number of people who are able to take the vaccine in the license, you know, before you approve it for children. Let's look at the CDC data, which is the most important data collection that's ever been made on anthrax vaccine. Why is that being hidden?
I don't know. I'm assuming that they have something to fear.
It's, you know, Scott Lilly at the Center for American Progress showed that the profit margin on the vaccine was 300%, much higher than for other vaccines, much higher than for other government contracts, which he said were usually in the order of 10% profit. So there's something very unique about this vaccine and about the company that makes it. The New York Times had a long article on fighting bioterrorism yesterday and what the government's been doing. And there was an amazing sentence quoting General Russell, who is a former commander at Fort Detrick, who has worked on developing a better anthrax vaccine. And General Russell said, and I quote, "Emergent," which is the manufacturer of anthrax vaccine, "Emergent bought the Congress." Quote, unquote. "Emergent bought the Congress." And he said that in the context of another second-generation vaccine that was in development that got squashed and was then bought by Emergent, but Emergent has not yet developed it. So, I mean, here's a general, here's the New York Times acknowledging what we all knew, but we weren't able to say. You know, money has changed hands. And you've got a very lucrative product, and it makes people sick, and some people don't care.
also, they're protected. You cannot sue the manufacturer. Mm-hmm. And that can't be said for any other type of medicine practiced in the United States. If you get sick from chemotherapy, heart medication, anti-psychiatric medication, you can sue the manufacturer. Not with vaccines. Also, we subsidize the making of vaccines. We guarantee their whole inventory be purchased, like the H1N1.
Mm-hmm.
And they make astronomical profits. And then they control the lobbyists, they control the consultants, they control the former legislators, they control the former scientists who went to work for them, including the head of the FDA and the head of the CDC's own vaccine oversight group, went to work for these people. So little wonder, then, that the whole thing is rigged. It's just bad science, it's bad public health, and we should not ever again allow our children to be drugged as another profit line for corporate America, with the full blessings of this particular nefarious president and his Congress. They are just sickening. All of them, to me, are just sickening individuals. You couldn't get lower on the human scale, evolutionary, in an evolutionary sense, than what we have in Washington, D.C. today. It's just a human cesspool. I have to take a shower for about 5 hours every time I leave Washington. Dr. Merrill Ness, thank you very much for being out there in a voice of reason, good science, and speaking on behalf of the American public, because it's sure as hell no one in Washington, in any agency of government or Congress, speaks on behalf of the American public.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. That's our program. Remember, a one-hour original in-depth investigative report. I'm going to take on the vaccine industry tonight at 7 p.m. over the Progressive Commentary on the Progressive Commentary Hour. This go to Progressive Radio Network at 7 p.m. and it will all be fully documented. It will be a full hour you won't want to miss. Have a nice day.
Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tappenfeld.